What this is more of a step by simple step progression of the absolute basics.
Definitely a fun time to be alive. You now take self-custody, you actually put in some time and you play with it, you move it around, you realize it's not scary.
If you're considering a blockchain project, it's basically, is what you're trying to store on the blockchain money? Yes or no?
Welcome to the Bitcoin Nova. Today I'm here with Sylvia Vasilic. And I am so excited to talk about her book today and her journey into Bitcoin and how, you know, she got to this point, how she got to being an author. And the book that you wrote is called Bitcoin Hands On. And I wanted to get into that because it's so important. There's so much fear about self-custody and aversion to trying to take your own responsibility for your Bitcoin. And that's actually the best gift Bitcoin gives us. So it's really nice to write a book, a manual to teach people, you know, how to do that. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I'm really excited to talk to you and to share my book and how I got into Bitcoin. Actually, the subtitle is 28 Learn by Doing Exercises to Master the Basics of Managing Your Own Bitcoin, including wallets, transactions, and self-custody. So it's very much focused on hands-on stuff, because there's a lot of stuff out there. Great books, wonderful books and articles about Bitcoin that talk about Bitcoin as money and Bitcoin as technology. It's all great information, and it helps you become convinced that Bitcoin is the best form of money. But it doesn't necessarily help you understand how to actually do it. And whenever you have tech and money, and also so many stories about what can happen if things go wrong, and oh, there's so many mistakes to make, and it's something new. So all of that together combines to create a lot of fear in people's mind, and in my mind as well. I mean, I had these same issues when I was first starting to self-custody, and I had problems. And I wrote the book for people like myself that, you know, are convinced, want to do self-custody, but you know, maybe they're a little bit intimidated and they don't know what is the absolute first step and then what. So yeah, that's why I wrote the book.
It's great because I've heard that from my mom. I've heard that from, you know, where I work. I work with my mom. I'm a hairdresser. But a lot of her clients, they know I'm doing a Bitcoin podcast and she loves what I'm doing, and her customers love watching the videos. You know, they've talked about seeing my channel. But I think what they were looking for is a Bitcoin basics kind of, what can I do? How do I use Bitcoin? You know, it's pretty much like, what is it? How do I use it? Maybe they don't want to know every single detail about Bitcoin. They just want to know what to do with a wallet. Where do I get the Bitcoin? How do I send the Bitcoin? So that is just getting to the point, you know, not confusing people with too much information, showing them how to use it. I love that because there's so many things in life. For example, doing hair and going to school to be a hairdresser, you could listen and learn all you want, but until you put in the experience and
it's a really good point.
Yeah. Until you actually do the job and actually you have to dive in. You know, you're not going to get better at anything unless you do it. So even once you finish school or even once you watch a video, a tutorial, until you actually send the Bitcoin, you know, actually, you know, save your seed phrase and write it down and like do the things you're supposed to do, do you actually say, oh, I did it. You know, now I have experience with this, you know, so yeah, experience is huge.
And that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book the way that I did, which is number one, I tell people when they're doing these exercises, do not use your life savings. You can do all of the exercises with about $25 worth of Bitcoin, and you'll actually have almost all of it left over, especially now since the fees are so low. You can do all these transactions and pay like 5 cents. It's really remarkably low. It's the lowest I've ever seen it. So it's a perfect time to do the exercises. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what really prevents people from getting into it, is they think not only is it something new and potentially difficult, but there's also a lot of money on the line. So when mm-hmm. there's just a little bit of money on the line, like $20, $25, it's a lot lower stress. And you don't need to be so, so concerned about security and go to some kind of safe room and make sure there's nobody around. It's a tiny amount of money. Well, it's $25 or so. And they can do it without worrying about anything. They just worry about the learning. And you're so right about actually doing it being the key to understanding. You have to do it. You cannot just watch videos.
And I remember the first time I sent Bitcoin from one wallet to another, It was very scary. And I wasn't sending the whole amount. I was just sending a portion. It was very scary, I think, until I did it a good 10 times. You know, I think by the time I did it, if, you know, more and more and more, then now I send it all the time and it's no big deal. I send it for payments. I check out on Bitcoin shops, you know, and I use my Bitcoin for payment and it's second nature, you know, but at first, you know, you have to do it a few times. But it's good that you're doing it with $25 or so, you know, you're not just going to like.
Otherwise, there's this huge thing in your head of worry where mm-hmm. you're like, oh, I better not make a mistake because it's a lot of money. And yeah. that's where a lot of people, unfortunately, start out. They don't practice with small amounts because they start maybe buying on an exchange. And then everybody says, oh, you have to do self-custody. So they take everything from the exchange and put it on their wallet. And it's maybe a larger amount. And there's a lot of stress involved with that. So, yeah.
Does your book teach people also about, you know, part of what taking self-custody is to me is you have to be responsible and know how to access this Bitcoin and be able to recover the Bitcoin using the seed phrase if you ever lose your device type of stuff, but also kind of like having a backup person in your life, like a child that's old enough to understand how to do this one day or a spouse. You know, I think a lot of people maybe think, well, now it's all on me and I'm the only one that knows this. And if they don't teach somebody, I think that that's maybe something that people are afraid of having all that responsibility on their own.
Yeah.
But I think Yeah.
And I think it's something that is kind of native to Bitcoiners that they can't shut up about it. So it just kind of happens that your nearest and dearest hopefully are interested at least a little bit and learn at least a little bit. But
and even if they don't know much, if they just know a little bit, then if ever something were to happen, it really isn't that hard. It's not like you have to take, you know what I mean, like a college course in understanding how to spend Bitcoin as long as you know.
Yeah, it can be understood by anybody who understands how bank accounts work, how checking accounts work, how a savings account works. Mm-hmm. It can totally be understood, but it's new. And so it is, you know, you do have to wrap your head around it a little bit. It is different in that you're not, you know, it's not an account with a password. And if you forget the password, that's fine. You just go to the bank or whatever. That's not what it is. If you, for whatever reason, lose your seed phrase and you don't have a backup, that's a big problem. And yeah, so I talk about that a lot. As a matter of fact, I have a bunch of different recovery steps because you're absolutely right. Recovery is really important. And also checking that the recovery went well and that you actually recovered what you thought you recovered is important as well. You can't just recover and say, oh, I have a wallet in, for instance, Sparrow, and now I've recovered that wallet in Blue Wallet. Well, as a matter of fact, this happened to me. I recovered a wallet in Blue Wallet and then received Bitcoin into that wallet. It turns out that the Blue Wallet was using a different script type, and thus it was giving me different addresses. And so when I looked for it, when I was, you know, back home again, I was like, oh my gosh, what happened? I was supposed to have some money in here from, you know, in this address, and it didn't come through. And it took me a while to understand that because there's really no resources.
Right.
There's a lot of resources out there, but there's kind of scattered. For instance, BTC Sessions, he has some great videos, and they're very useful. But what this is more of a step-by-simple-step progression of the absolute basics. But getting to things that are more advanced, like understanding a little bit, not a lot, about like things like script type and recovery, using different open source applications. In this book, I have people using Sparrow and Blue Wallet mostly, and then a little bit of Blockstream. In my next book, I'm using Sparrow, Blue Wallet, and Nunchuck. Mm-hmm. Nunchuck has made some real upgrades and they're quite easy to use now. Yes, I think that's also important is being able to understanding that your private key, your seed phrase is not somehow attached to the wallet. It's an independent thing. And you can and should understand how to recover it in different apps. There's nothing special to Sparrow in that it has to be done on Sparrow. It's platforming.
I love that about Bitcoin. Once you realize that the words, which are the password, you know, to your Bitcoin, those words are literally a key you could take anywhere with you to any device, to any, you know, application, but those words should never be shared online as well. Like those are the things that are important to know, that those words are literally a key to your vault. So the words matter, you know, but the device the device you're using is the signing device. So like you giving access to that money to be sent, to that Bitcoin to be sent. So you're just saying, yes, this is okay. I approve this. That's what your device is for. You're approving the transactions. So it's just like, what device do you prefer to use? But really, is it, if you lose your seed phrase, just so people know, you know, even if you have your device still active and connected, you can still transfer the funds to a new wallet and get a new seed phrase for that new, or
if you have your hardware wallet with the PIN.
Yeah, if you have their hardware wallet with the PIN, even if you lose the seed phrase, you just have to immediately transfer it somewhere you know where the seed phrase is in case you ever lose the device. Because then if you lose the device and the seed phrase, that's when problems happen. Yeah, so it's like not like, oh my God, I don't know where I put the seed phrase. But once you realize that, if you still have that device, you have to make sure you know where the new wallet seed phrase is and, you know, have access to that. You know, make sure those steps are done. So yeah, it's like two things. Two parts, words, key to the vault, and the device, the hardware device, which says,
And one of the things that I go through is that I don't necessarily believe that the hardware device should be the very first thing that you set up. I think, especially with small amounts of money anyway, small amounts of Bitcoin, it's completely fine and actually preferable to just understand the concept. What is a private key? What is a seed phrase? How does it represent a private key? How do you recover? What is the passphrase as well? All those things. And then decide about hardware wallets. Don't confuse yourself by saying, oh, I must have a hardware wallet immediately. Hardware wallets are if you have a lot of assets that you want to transfer. And at that point, get a hardware wallet. But make sure you understand before anything else what the seed phrase is, how to recover, how it's transferable between different types of Bitcoin wallets. That's really important. Another thing that I go into, what I try to do is oriented around what are some of the most common mistakes that people have or people make. And apparently, I've heard this from a number of people now, one of the most common ways for people to lose their Bitcoin permanently is if they have a seed phrase, they write it down, they also have a passphrase that they think they're always going to remember. They don't write it down. They don't really consider that. If they forget that, it is completely gone. They cannot recover the Bitcoin if they don't also have the passphrase completely accurate. I've heard from a number of people that that's one of the most common ways that people will lose Bitcoin is by forgetting the passphrase, making it
too
complicated.
So the passphrase, let's say the passphrase is on a, let's say, a Ledger Live or something on your PC, but if you delete that application or re-download it, does it still remember the passphrase for that?
I don't believe it will. No, you need to, unless your passphrase is something that you practice. And so either your passphrase is very short and you know you're going to remember it, then that's fine, I guess. But in general, a passphrase should really consider all of the implications of a passphrase and understand that it kind of becomes at that point a two of two multisig. So you have to have both pieces of information in order to sign transaction and send Bitcoin from that wallet.
Oh, so it's for sending. It's not like, let's say, in order to view, you know, how you have password protection on, you know, let's say a wallet that's on your computer. If, let's say, you were to be hacked or something, they would need a numerical code to get in to see the balance. Like, that's not the same thing. You're saying a passphrase is for sending, like an additional layer.
So a passphrase actually has... So there's a, for instance, Sparrow and a lot of wallets have a password or a PIN. So in Sparrow wallet, Bitcoin wallet software, you can set a password up on your wallet file. That's different. If you set a password up on your wallet file, then somebody can't open up Sparrow while you're away from your computer and just open up that wallet without having the password. The passphrase is part of the BIP39 standard, which is where the seed words came in. The passphrase is something that actually alters the seed phrase. So if you have a certain seed phrase with no passphrase on it, then that's one private key. If you have a certain seed phrase and then you do have a specific passphrase on it, that's another private key.
So it makes it a multi-sig, right?
So to see your assets, you need both because they form completely different private keys.
That's interesting that that is a very common way that people lose their Bitcoin, though, because you hear that saying that, you know, it's not usually an attacker or a hacker that always does it. It's your own worst enemy because you forget or you don't write down or you're not sure where you put it. So that's interesting because it's meant to be an extra layer of security to make sure that if someone gets access to those words, they don't steal it because they need a second layer to actually make the transaction. But if you aren't responsible.
Yeah. And there's always that dynamic between complexity and extra security and too complex to remember and understand. And so that's where the passphrase kind of comes in. I definitely say I have people experiment with it in one of the exercises, but then I do have a big caveat. And a lot of the wallet software now does have a big caveat about, are you sure you want to include a passphrase and only for experts?
Mm-hmm.
Because it does become kind of like a two of two multi-sig where you have to have both secrets, especially if your passphrase is really long and impossible to guess, then it's, you have to.
Yeah. So could it be like words or could it be letters and numbers or is it
just? It can be any letters and numbers. It does not have to be just the actual words, the BIP39 seed phrase words. As a matter of fact, but I've heard of people having, say they have three kids and each of the three kids has a separate Bitcoin setup. So there's one seed phrase and then three separate passphrases.
Mm.
And those create three different private keys. So it's nice. Kind of a convenient way of saying, oh, here's the seed phrase and here's the passphrase. And so this creates three separate accounts, basically.
Right. So technically, you don't have to have for three different kids have three different seed phrases. You could have the same seed phrase for all three kids, but then they would be able to access their own set of or their own pretty much account in Bitcoin, sort of like.
Exactly. You know. Yeah, that's right. And it seems like a really good usage. Although I guess if you just put the kids' names, like, you know, Joe, Susan, whatever, then each of the kids could probably see the other kids' accounts and access those. But
yeah,
whatever security you'd want to put in place.
Yeah, I know. You have to know, like, do your kids trust each other when they become adults? Will they have, who knows? But I think, yeah, it's nice to be aware of the different options, you know? So you have to just weigh the pros and the cons and how good you are at, or how complicated you want to make it, how simple you want to make the passphrase portion. And to just be aware that, you know, you need both of those things because now it's locked up.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things I don't get into in this book, but what will be coming in the next book is multisig. Because multisig is another thing that people, you know, especially if you have a few more assets in Bitcoin, multisig is something that you kind of should set up. But it's like regular Bitcoin self-custody, but then even more so, you know, just because you have three secrets and they should be geographically separate. You don't have to have three, but that's what most people do is a two or three multisig. And they should be geographically separate. So you need three different locations and it all adds up. So I'm working on how to make it as step-by-step as possible, if you know what I mean, because I don't want to just jump right in there and say, okay, here's your multisig, here's all the different steps to set it up, but just to make it really understandable.
What are your thoughts on, you know, because I love what the Bitcoin Advisor does for people who want more of a hands-off approach and they want advisorship, you know, they want somebody to help them along the way if they have, let's say, a larger amount of assets that they control that they just don't want to screw it up, you know. So for people who just want to make sure they have an advisor, you know, there's other things like, I know you can create your own multi-sig setup, but there's that BitKey wallet that they call the wallet of the future. I don't know. What are your thoughts on the BitKey?
The BitKey wallet, I guess my preference is for wallet software where you can easily transfer it between wallets. And my understanding is that BitKey is not like that. You can't, it's somehow encrypted in the devices is my understanding. I haven't looked into it a ton. I have never used it, but it's not like setting up a multi-sig wallet in, for instance, Sparrow, and then having separate hardware wallets controlling that, or using something like SeedSigner, which is an open source hardware wallet. I don't know if you've heard of that, but I find it really impressive. Yeah.
Well, that's why I think that when they call it the wallet of the future, I think it's because when you think about mass adoption and Bitcoin and more people being self-sovereign and, you know, not relying on another party, but the fact that it is multi-sig is the simpler you can make something, the more people will adopt it and use it and make it, I don't want to say plug and play, but like make it easy enough that it could be more mainstream without people having to do too much work. Because I think the more, you know, yes, people can do this. It's not hard. If you just take a little bit of time, it's really not hard to do. But I think what BitKey is the key itself is a key. The phone that you connected to is a key. And then the company itself holds the third key. And I think that, yeah, if you lose your phone, you could just get another phone. And then your device plus the company could help you recover that. Plus, if you lose the device. But there's no seed phrase with
that. Right. There's no seed phrase type backup, which
there's no seed phrase backup. It's literally the three keys, which is the company, the phone, and the wallet, you know, the device.
Right.
So, yeah. And even if something happens to the company, then you still have your phone and the device and you can move it somewhere. You know, you don't need their permission to move it, but it's two out of three keys always, you know, so.
Right. Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean,
I think doing the self-custody the way that, you know, doing these exercises and actually taking self-custody of your Bitcoin is definitely not for everybody, not at this stage. I think there will be more and better tools. And I think there's getting to be more tools all the time. Sparrow is getting easier to use. Blue Wallet is getting easier to use. Nunchuck in particular, which is a phone Bitcoin wallet that offers a lot of multi-sig capability. Between the last version and this one, they have gotten a lot better, a lot easier to understand and to use. So it's improving all the time.
Does Nunchuck have a device as well, or is it just an app?
My understanding is it is just a phone wallet, but you can set up shared custody within a group of, so different people can install Nunchuck and they can share custody that way.
Okay.
So I haven't delved into the multi-sig aspect of it, which is mainly what it's for, but it just the beginning looking at it is, it seems like it's very capable.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I know that because, you know, a lot of people have iPhones and Nunchuck is it's iPhone, Android, it's a phone app, right? So you could download it anywhere. You know, one thing that I've, a common mistake people make, or, you know, something I know that's happened to a few people is even the Apple Store, you know, the Apple Store that's, you think is very trustworthy and there's no spam or bad apps on there. There are other times, not Nunchuck, but there's been versions of Sparrow that people have downloaded.
Yeah.
That Sparrow does not have an app. It's only on computer, on PC, like you download it there, but they don't have an app version. But there are fake Sparrow wallets and some other wallets from other companies that do make it onto the App Store, even the Apple App Store. And the common mistake is that you just assume these companies are protecting
legit.
You and yeah. They're legit because they wouldn't allow these fraudulent apps on the App Store. But they do get on there and they are known to get taken down and come back few months later, and they have hurt a lot of people. So I feel like at some point,
one of the things that comes up a lot. You're right. And I do.
And the reason they hurt people, it's not because they are just, oh my gosh, I got duped. That's one thing that people miss. They misjudge because they trust Apple. You know, they think Apple wouldn't allow this. So then if it asks for your seed phrase when you download it, that's always a no-no. You're never, ever, ever supposed to share that. And that's that way no one can ever take your Bitcoin. If you don't share your seed phrase online ever, it's only yours with a new device to, you know, recover, not with someone online to share it. And people do thinking that they could trust it. So that's the common mistake. I mean, it's like if Nunchuck were to be downloaded, I mean, it wouldn't ask for, would it ask for your seed phrase if you wanted to import a wallet, let's say? That would be the only time.
If you recover a wallet in Nunchuck, then yeah, you have to type in your seed phrase.
Right. And I think that's what maybe makes people nervous that what if somebody, but I don't think it could, it's only, I think it's happening to these people once they download it and it asks them, hey, let's connect, you know, your wallet and then let's put your seed phrase in. But
yeah.
You're
right. Verifying the wallet is really important.
And checking the reviews, right? Like Nunchuck would have good reviews.
Checking the number of downloads.
Mm-hmm.
But number one, going to a website that you recognize and know and that other people have said, yeah, this is the website.
Yes.
Yeah. Sparrow had, I think it was like, right now it's like sparrowwallet.com. Oh, I better say it right. Hold on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sparrowwallet.com.
See, and Nunchuck has Oh, I don't know if you guys could see it, but I'll tell you. But it says a Nunchuck Bitcoin wallet. It says 4.9 rating, 5 stars, you know, so, and it's got 413 ratings. So then, you know, okay, 413 people rated it 5 stars. You know, it's good. Let's see if the Spiro wallet is on there. Sorry if I
Oh,
cut
that'd
you
be
off. I
sad if
know.
it was. Because I think there are people who are trying to prevent that, but I haven't looked.
Yeah. I don't see it on here now, but it's
Good.
known to come back at times. But I would always check. I don't see any right now that look like they're 1-star apps.
Yeah.
So that's great news, you know, but always watch out for an app that, you know, you don't know if Spiro has an app store one yet. Look it up. Try to look up news. Did Spiro actually come up with a, you know, find out. And if it has 1 star, do not download that wallet. You know, do not, people are saying it's, they're warning you know, so check
Yeah.
the stars, check them on reviews. Always double check that stuff. But Blue Wallet, you know, great. It's got 811 4-star reviews. That's legit. You know, other ones have a lot too. Like, so anything that's not like a 1 or 2 star with,
Yeah.
you
And
know.
also websites. For instance, you're mentioning Sparrow Wallet. There used to be, I don't know if there still is, I haven't checked recently, there used to be a fraudulent website called sparrowwallet.net instead of .com. And it
Okay.
was a complete fraud that whatever software you download there, it would steal your seed phrase.
Jeez, yeah, that's crazy.
So yeah, you have to check, make sure that you're downloading from the actual correct site and
And
just.
this is not just in Bitcoin, right? It's not like, oh, Bitcoin, you
Yeah.
can get scammed. It's like you can get scammed more off of someone sending you a link to your email address and getting access to all your information,
Yeah.
your banking information, your credit card, or identity theft. You know, there's so much that could happen to you outside of the Bitcoin world. So it's not like these should be aversions to be scared of in Bitcoin.
Yeah,
Bitcoin
that's a good
protects
point. I mean,
you
so many
from,
phone calls that you get are completely scam phone calls,
yes,
completely
everything.
fraudulent.
You know, I'm convinced these scam phone calls, I almost feel like I had this thought the other day, sorry to get sidetracked on this topic, but it's like whoever is behind, like literally everyone gets 10 a day, you know, plus voicemail, even if you have them blocked, you're getting so many a day. And I think that I know personally, I hate talking on the phone. I love talking on the podcast and in person to people, but when people call me on the phone, I cannot stand being on a phone call. And I wonder if that's because, you know, you get so many phone calls a day. They're all fake. So you just have so many numbers blocked that you don't know. And you're just so used to just silencing phone calls and you never want to answer them. So it's almost like breaking down in society, like the
The
way that
idea of
people
picking up the phone,
communicate.
especially
Yeah.
with
Because,
young people, they almost never pick up the phone.
yeah, it's like people hate phones on, like talking on phones now. And I think, like,
Yeah.
is this part of it? Like you have a PTSD of someone calling you because it's a spam phone call and everyone's like, ah, I hate phones, you know?
Yeah.
So I just wonder if they're ruining, you know, the communication in society
Yeah,
because,
texting is definitely the way things are going nowadays.
yeah, I really don't enjoy talking. It's, I mean, I love talking on here. It's very funny, but if
When
someone
you actually
calls
set
me, I'm like,
something up and you can see the person, it's a little bit of a different story.
Yeah, but if someone calls you most of the time, you're like, can you just text me? Like, let me know what it is. What is it? Are you
Yeah.
okay?
I used to be a big email person, but now everybody else has moved to texting, so I guess I have to move as well. So I mostly text nowadays also,
Yeah.
along with the whole world.
I know. That's the way it's going until, and even they spam you in the text. But see, all those things could be scams. You know, it's like every one of those phone calls is someone trying to manipulate you and trick you. And so many times it's trying to scare you, trying to say you didn't pay your
IRS is
tollway
going to knock on
bill.
your door.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. All these ways that they try to get you to call them and to like give them money or to access your information. And
Yeah,
it's
and
not
especially older people are really vulnerable to that.
right. I mean, it's crazy. It's like I even think like look at how nobody even has house phones these days. Because if you were to plug in a house phone, it would just be all spam. Like who?
Yeah.
It's just what's the point of that?
The
But I think
house
that
phone crowd is all over 80, I think, or over 75 at least, and nobody else has a house phone anymore.
yeah, and those poor people are getting harassed, having their phone ring off the hook all day. No wonder they're getting scammed. Because it's like if they're lonely and they're like, I just want someone to talk to, they'll talk to this person, and you know.
I've had numerous elderly family members and friends and neighbors who have been scammed for significant amounts of money and nothing to do with Bitcoin, actually, but just, you know, these people know how to manipulate, that's for sure.
Yeah, so it's not just, you know, a Bitcoin thing. You have to be aware all the time. You know, you have to be aware of what you're clicking on, what you're running on your computer, you know, who's sending you this stuff, and being very aware at all times about people trying to take advantage of you.
Yeah.
But the
And
main
knowing
thing.
where the big risks are, like you said, a lot of the big risks are if you download an app and it's a fake app, that's bad and that's common. And there's all kinds of people trying to manipulate you into doing that. And the other, there's the other type of risk, which is, for instance, you use a passphrase on your seed phrase and then you forget the passphrase. That's another huge risk. What are some of the other risks? Actually, I think a big risk that is not talked about enough is not owning Bitcoin. That's actually
That's
a pretty
the
big
biggest.
Risk, especially when you consider the way the economy is going, the way the money printing is going. I think people in their whole universe of risk need to consider, what if you're just holding assets that are depreciating the whole time? That's a risk. That's something that you need to be concerned about.
Such a great point.
Yeah. And one thing that I'm really grateful to Bitcoin and, you know, just some of the books I've read about Bitcoin about is learning about money and inflation in general, because I didn't really understand that inflation is theft. The thought had never crossed my mind. Inflation seemed like a force of nature that, of course, there's inflation. How could you expect there to not be inflation? And then you learn more about money. And I particularly appreciate the book, The Bitcoin Standard.
Mm-hmm.
It's an excellent book, just amazing. But you learn more about money and you realize what are the characteristics of money. And one of them, of course, is that it is limited. There's a strictly limited amount of it, or it's very hard to create in the sense of gold, for instance. In Bitcoin, there's a strictly limited amount. In gold, it's very expensive to mine it, which limits the amount. But of course, in fiat currency, you can just add a few zeros on a computer screen and boom, you got a lot more money out there that the government is able to take advantage of. So I really appreciate Bitcoin for teaching me that. And it's interesting that I'm pretty well read, but I had never been exposed to that idea before.
Exactly. Isn't that, that's the craziest thing to me, that so many people that
yeah,
are
we don't
well
learn
educated.
That anywhere in school or anywhere, except gold bugs. Gold bugs knew this a long time ago, but I had never really been a gold bug and hadn't been exposed to it. But the gold bugs understand. They're just, I think, now going down. I mean, gold is going up too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Bitcoin, I believe, is superior to gold.
Yeah. I mean, it's literally what gold is, but more scarce. Finite, you know,
more scarce and easier to transport, way
easier to transport. Yeah, you can't just send your gold or take it with you on a plane if you want to, you know, leave the country or something. But like, yeah, you can send it for very cheap. You can, it's free for you to move around with it. There's so many reasons why it's like gold, but way better. And I just cannot, that's one of the things that, you know, as a hairstylist, I talk to clients about my podcast and, you know, they always like want to get around to watching it. And some of them do, but recently, there was somebody talking to me, asking actually questions. I try not to just bombard people with Bitcoin information unless they start asking.
I was like that too.
Yeah. I'm like, let me just wait for the question. Now that they know what I'm doing, let's just see when they ask, you know. So he started asking a few things. And that's the one thing I really made sure to say is that inflation is theft and Bitcoin is finite. And that's why it goes up in value, you know, and I'm like, it's finite because nobody could change the rules of that game, you know, and I think those couple talking points that I had with this person finally got him to go and watch an episode. It was the first time I saw him comment on an episode. And he actually did go and watch and he said, great talk, you know, great episode, you know, so I'm like, okay, he went home and he watched one, you know, and I was like, that made me happy because it seems like when you don't try to convince people, but they know what you're all about and they know that you're passionate about this, but then you just lay off. I think when you take a step back and let people come to you and just answer the questions they have, then it allows them to feel like you're not forcing it upon them. They're making their own decision, you know, and then, but just telling them the truth. Nobody, like you said, you're well educated, but you didn't hear about this before. It wasn't something that you even understood was a problem or, you know, even
like most
about.
People are educated in government schools and government schools are not going to teach how inflation is theft because the government is printing money all the time. So it's not to their benefit to be teaching this kind of stuff.
I even love now that Bitcoin charities, when you think about a Bitcoin charity and a multi-sig setup for a nonprofit, I love that idea because I personally don't like donating to charities where I don't know that I'm going to be giving the, you know, if I'm, you know, giving away items, you know, I could give them somewhere where I know where they're going instead of, you know, but as far as money, donating money, you hear all the time, you know, even with Doge, when they were uncovering how much money was sent here and there, it's like,
yeah,
maybe 1% gets to the cause that they say that it was set up for. And all the money in between is funneled away to everybody involved and
all the employees and all the costs and expenses. Yeah. Honestly, charity is another one of those things. The deeper you delve into it, most of them, not all of them, the more you realize, wow, it's not what you think.
Isn't it crazy? So people get tax breaks for donating to a charity, right? So a lot of people donate to charities and all the money they're donating gets just split amongst themselves and nobody that needs it really gets it. So you're getting a tax break to enrich people that are starting nonprofits. You know, you're not giving it to the people that need it. So I think that when it comes to Bitcoin, you can actually, like, Bitcoin fixes this. Bitcoin fixes people wanting to be charitable and donate to a cause where you know that there's a multi-sig setup where not one person can run off with the Bitcoin. I explained this to that person, too. This was one of the things that I think, besides the finite aspect, I explained to him that, you know, charities I don't like. You know, I don't like when I don't know where my money's going. But Bitcoin fixes that. Bitcoin shows you, hey, if you're donating money to this charity, there has to be multiple parties approving the spending of this. And if you see over time, hey, I'm donating to this community project and nothing is being built and there's no funds in that wallet set up that we could see that there should be this much Bitcoin there and accumulating more and progress being made in this community, right?
But
instead, there's nothing happening. And, you know that, okay, this is not legit. There's nothing, you guys, this group of people is stealing the money. It's not going, we're not seeing improvement. You know, it's not something that, so I think it helps stabilize and fix communities
around
you.
It sounds like it was a good orange pilling tactic as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think it really made sense to him to think of it as, hey, it's a humanitarian thing.
Yeah.
You can actually fix the world around you and donate to things that matter without it being stolen, because there's theft everywhere and Bitcoin fixes theft.
Yeah. Another thing that I have found helps people understand is, this is another term that I had not even heard of before learning about Bitcoin, is the financialization of real estate. So basically meaning that, why are houses so expensive? It's because people understand that cash is trash, that the dollar is trash. And so they want to buy something that is harder to build, harder to create, and will not lose value as fast as the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
So people with assets buy houses, which makes them, of course, way more expensive for people who just want houses as a place to live. So
that was,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. That was an orange pilling moment for me too, because I realized that, you know, people that like to invest and make money, they don't like to hold it in cash. They like to invest and buy properties. But then I think when it was Michael Saylor who mentioned the properties are a bad form of investment over time.
He had an awesome talk on that. It was like 20 points why they were, or maybe 21 points why real estate was a bad investment. That was really good.
Yeah. And it was the family farm story that got me, because over the generations, I think it was a Robert Breedlove talk. I don't remember. It was early on. But there was the story of the family losing the family farm. And it's like, because you have this farm, you pass it down to generations, the next generation, like you have this piece of land and then a government moves in or a city or a town kind of comes along and they build up the town and they say, now you owe us taxes because now this land is part of our community and whatever. So you start having to pay taxes where you never did before. Then the next generation, the taxes keep rising and rising. Then you have property costs and maintenance, including the taxes. Then you can't afford to pay the taxes anymore. One day you have to sell the property and take the cash, which is trash, you know?
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
Eventually now your kids, the next generation, now they're left with cash that keeps depreciating because they can't afford another property and property taxes and all the stuff that goes along with that. So if you're not, so that's how people and families lose things like this over the years, over generations. But it's, if you're going to choose Bitcoin, something finite that appreciates over time, like look at the big picture, over housing that, like you said, it's going to fix housing because all these people are buying it up.
Or be an asset that you want to, it won't be a store of value anymore. It'll just be something that you use. And that depreciates. It won't be a store of value like, oh, I'm going to put my money in the house because I got to put it somewhere.
And then you're buying up all these properties and people don't have places to live because there's...
Exactly. Yeah.
You're the ones that
need to live. S&P 500 or the stock market. People are buying randomly into the stock market, not thinking, oh, this stock is going to do really well, or this stock is really going to do really well. They're just buying the indexes, which is a, it's just basically putting your money into something because you can't save money. You cannot have a savings account and expect to save money. You have to put it somewhere. That's why they're putting it in real estate and index funds. And yeah, Bitcoin is going to fix all that.
And that's what's scary, to think that anyone who knows that you need to invest, anyone who understands that saving money doesn't work, and anybody who knows that you need to invest in property or stock market indexes, whatever.
Hard assets of any kind, yeah.
Yeah, anything you have to invest in, you already know that saving money doesn't work. You know that you need to invest in something. And then when you find out that Bitcoin is the only thing that is absolutely scarce in the world and unchangeable by any government or human in the world, it's very, I mean, it's mind-blowing. It's a mind-blowing,
it mind-blowing
realization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I had a, my heritage is Austrian, mm-hmm. and I have an aunt that lived through the inflation. Well, no, she didn't live through it. Her parents lived through the inflation of the post-World War I inflation, which was really bad. It basically destroyed the currency within 3 or 4 years, maybe. But she had some banknotes left over from not even the central bank of Austria, but all of the little local communities were printing their own money at the very end of the inflation. And so she had some of these notes that were, you know, a million, whatever they were using, mm-hmm. Schilling, I think, in Austria. And it's just really crazy to think that this note used to be valuable, mm-hmm. and now it's worth nothing except as a curiosity or a collector's item. And that's happened in so many places in the world. We actually bought on eBay once, just as a fun present for the kids, a Zimbabwean mm-hmm. $1 trillion note or something like that.
I want one of those. That'd be fun to have for a...
Yeah, it's around here somewhere.
It's a mystery.
Well, you know, obviously, you know, they're just printing these things. And it really, once you see that over and over again, and if you learn about the history of money, you will see it over and over again. It yeah. just really starts to sink in. It's just a piece of paper. That's all it is. Or it's just numbers on a computer. It's not something scarce at all.
Right. And then I'm sorry, what were you saying?
It's not scarce. And then you learn Bitcoin is scarce. So, yeah.
I was watching this TV show. It's actually a terrible show. I don't suggest it, but we stopped watching it. But I thought it was interesting because it reminds me always of, it's called Money Heist. And it was where these robbers, they want to pull off the biggest heist, and they decide to steal from the bank, pretty much the treasury of Spain, you know, so they break into the treasury, they lock it down, they decide we're going to print our own money and just take it, you know, so we're just going to print for however long we can hold hostages in there, print the money. And that's how we'll make billions of dollars. You know, we'll just we'll make them, literally make them ourselves, like we're going to take over this place and make our own money. And technically, it's not, it's real money because it's from the treasury. But it's just funny how counterfeiting money is illegal if the government doesn't do it. But if the government prints it, it's legal.
That's another thing that Bitcoin brought me, is that this whole concept of counterfeiting. So somebody that's not government, if they counterfeit, then that's horrific and it's a huge crime. But the government can print, can double the money supply yeah. in a year.
Without anyone's vote,
nobody
chooses this. Nobody says, yeah. go and spend insane amounts of money on yourselves and your friends and places we don't know where this money is going. And you're making life harder for the people when they're yeah. not earning any more every year. You're making life more expensive by doing this.
You're stealing. You're taking money out of their pocket.
Yes. Yeah. And they're literally stealing from you. And it's
literally.
Okay if your government can steal from you. And that's totally fine. But then they're going to... Why don't we just all start printing money? Like, I mean, just everyone, I'm sorry, maybe that's bad advice, but everyone should just start printing money too. Like,
you
I'm
know,
sorry.
I found
like,
that one way of getting people to understand that is using the analogy of a Monopoly game. So mm-hmm. in a Monopoly yeah. game, you have the banker, of course. Mm-hmm. And so if that banker, you know, behind his back took out another Monopoly game, took the money from that and used that for himself, they could do whatever. They could buy all the property. It's very similar to what's happening now. You know, they just print whatever they want.
I heard that the rules of Monopoly, it literally says if the bank runs out of money, they can write on slips of paper extra money.
Really?
That's like the rules of the game. So then you could just keep writing up slips and being like, well, I'm just always going to have money. I'm never going to run out of it. So that's yeah. So they literally took their playbook from Monopoly. You know, yeah. It's like, we're just going to just write extra slips all the time. We'll never.
Or maybe Monopoly took its playbook from, because the Federal Reserve was what, 1913, and Monopoly was created in the 30s. So they're like, Monopoly.
Well, you know, the promise the government always makes, saying that, like, we will always pay our bills. We will always have money to pay the bills. It's like, it reminds me of Game of Thrones, where a Lannister always pays its debts, because it's like, you can make this promise because you know that you can spend extravagantly and you will always just print more to pay for it. Like, you're never going to have to worry because you can just keep rising up to the top because you have so much more of this money while people get poorer, you know? Yeah. You don't
and
care
that's
if you
exactly
step on everybody.
They're,
yeah, you step on
money,
everybody.
So they get poor.
All your people along the way, as long as you can pay everything and live a lavish life, you know. So it's just an insane idea once you realize the truth. You know, the truth is that you need to wake up.
Yeah.
Period.
People need to wake up, and this book, The Bitcoin Hands-On, is not the wake people up book. I've had so my kind of orange pilling moments were read. I'd heard about Bitcoin a long time ago, just reading articles in the paper and Wall Street Journal, and I knew it was something I should be interested in and I should learn more. And it stayed that way for a long time, unfortunately. But then somehow I ran into the article, which I don't know if you've heard of, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin by Deepshay Boyapati. Yeah. And I read that article carefully because I was already interested. I just had never really, I mean, nobody orange-pilled me or anything. I just hadn't really run into a good article.
Mm-hmm.
So I read that, and after reading that, I thought to myself, I have to find more to read on this topic. And then I found The Bitcoin Standard, and I read that, and I went down the rabbit hole. That was the beginning, and that's how I learned about money and how money needs to be scarce. And if it's not scarce, it's bad money. And bad money is always replaced over a long enough time frame by good money. And so I went down that rabbit hole, and that was just
and eventually
mind-blowing, like it is to everybody.
Right. And eventually it gets replaced by perfect money.
Perfect money. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's where we're at now. We're living at a time where there is perfect money.
There's perfect money available, but it's not widespread yet for sure. I mean, sometimes I'm just really struck by the fact that we are still so early, even though we're not early.
I know.
Technically speaking, but we're still so early in terms of what people think and how they regard money and how they regard inflation and that kind of thing. In that regard, we are very, very early. People
Isn't
have this thing
amazing?
In their mind, oh, you know, back 10 years ago, it was $100 or whatever it was. But yeah, it was. And it's whatever it is, like 90K now. So that's a huge leap. And you think, how could it possibly go up more? But when so many people don't understand what Bitcoin is and where it's going to go, then yeah, it's inevitably going to go up a ton more. So we're not too late, basically.
Yeah, we're not. I think that it's insane to comprehend that because people, you know, someone I spoke to recently, they had gotten into Bitcoin when it was around maybe 80, maybe sold around 90. I don't know, because they like got, you know, they. No, I think they got into maybe they got into it. I think they got into it at 90,000 and sold at 80 because it was dropping. So they got scared and sold. And then they were like, yeah, I don't want to do that, you know, because Bitcoin just, that's what it does to people. People get greedy. They think the price is going up. I'm going to get in on it. Then they get scared because they are traders.
Yeah.
But then it went up to like 120 something. And I think I saw this person recently and they're like, oh yeah, Bitcoin's at like 90 again now. And I'm like, yeah, it got up to like 120. He's like, oh, that'd be great if I held on till then and sold. And I'm like, I don't sell Bitcoin. I don't trade Bitcoin. I hold it long term, you know, like wrong mentality. You're playing with something like, I just think of it like you're playing with fire. You're playing with something different than you're used to. Just hold it long term. It's not meant to be traded. You're always going to kick yourself, you know, when you sell at the wrong time.
People are going to learn. It'll just take a while.
Yeah. But I think that if you understand anything about Bitcoin, you understand how much Bitcoin total there is and how often new Bitcoin comes out. When you think about the percent of people in the world that understand it now, we are so lucky to be this early, and we are trying to help people understand that 100,000, okay, you think, how could it go higher? Because it's 100,000, 90,000, whatever. At this time, people think, how could it go up higher? This is going to crash, you know. But when you think about how much of it has come out and we're here, like, as far as how much total, and then it's going to go like this forever, you know, like, for like till the year 2140, it's going to be like a sliver of Bitcoins coming out for 100 years.
Yeah.
Like, what are we in the year, in the 16th year of Bitcoin?
Is that
and
right?
I know 2140, it ends. So how many more years of this is it going to be coming out in like slivers of Bitcoin? As far as what new Bitcoin is released and mined. And it's like we're at the very beginning chunk. And then that's where I think we have this, you know, gradually then suddenly phase, because it's like once that big hump disappears, you know, and then we have that gradual thing, that's when the how much more money you need to buy this thing, you know, it's going to flip. It's going
to
flip.
Yeah. I'm curious as to how much Bitcoin, I know there's some estimates out there, but how much Bitcoin has been permanently lost. I wonder how much is just never going to move until maybe quantum computing is, you know, starting to crack some of the earlier Bitcoin wallets, which are, I believe they're less quantum proof.
Okay, they are.
I think the earlier ones, if they haven't moved at all, they might be less quantum proof.
So you think Satoshi's wallet is quantum proof?
I think if it hasn't moved. Because there's been some improvements, haven't there, to make Bitcoin more quantum proof, but only the later addresses are using that?
I wonder. I never thought about it in the way where if it's like they're changing up how the wallets are encrypted or secured or the seed phrases are stored. But I think as far as mining, I was always thinking about technology advancing, and I thought about the difficulty adjustment and how Bitcoin adjusts every 10 minutes. And if people try to mine Bitcoin faster, there's no way to speed up this block time. It's like block time
because of the difficulty adjustment. Yeah.
Yeah, it has been programmed to get harder, exponentially harder, if computers get smarter and faster. But I never really thought about it as hacking a wallet or finding out the seed phrase combinations. I don't know how that would work. I'm actually curious about that.
Yeah, I'm not going to say anything definitive about it, but I believe I've read some articles that implied that the earlier addresses and the earlier wallets, well, the earlier addresses that earlier wallets created are less.
I can believe that.
Less resistant to quantum computing.
I would hope that some quantum computer, that if somebody were to decide to hack into, let's say, Satoshi's wallet, I don't know. I'm too optimistic about people's goodness in the future. But I think if it's somebody who is a Bitcoiner that gets to that wallet, they could redistribute all of Satoshi's coins amongst every wallet out there and just kind of like a starburst and just hand it out to everybody that's got one. So I'm like, I would say open up a wallet today. Just in case. Who knows if somebody were to be able to be behind this hack and be able to want to be give another gift, like Satoshi gave everyone a gift already. And, you know, it'd be cool if someone like that did it instead of somebody who is a bad person that wants to be greedy.
One can only hope, right?
I would hope. I mean,
that'd be an expensive transaction.
It would be.
I mean, that'd be a really expensive transaction.
I mean, imagine like a one-time drop that would, who knows? I don't even know. That's just a crazy, wild, you know, dream, I think, instead of something that would actually happen.
Yeah. Who knows what's going to happen with quantum computing and when it comes along.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know there's a lot of defenses in Bitcoin, so it's not like I'm worried about it. But I have heard something about the earlier wallets being a little more vulnerable. So,
yeah, we'll that is definitely something that's,
into that, actually.
If anyone knows any of this information, you know, any thoughts on this episode, comment. I love to see the comments. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these topics. It's definitely interesting to watch. It's definitely a fun time to be alive instead of a scary time once you understand Bitcoin and you are outside of that fear-based loop that you've been living in and worry. I think once you become a Bitcoiner, you know, and you have conviction, you understand how this thing works. You now take self-custody. You actually put in some time and you play with it. You move it around. You realize it's not scary. And you just take the right steps to make sure it's secured, and you just don't do things like share your seed phrase online. So there's certain things you could do, certain practices you make. And I love that you made this book and you're coming out with more, you know, to help break things down simply for people. But what a fun time to be alive, you know?
Yeah, it is an amazing time to be alive, especially if you have conviction. That's the can be for some people a harder part is building the conviction. But yeah, once you have an understanding of what hopefully will happen with Bitcoin, it's a different world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that I don't know, the more that inflation progresses, I wonder how much more pain people have to see in their purchasing power day to day. How much more of a breaking point do people need to get to? Like the mass majority, because, you know, they say middle class is the biggest chunk of people, right?
I definitely feel like I'm hearing more comments in the grocery store now about, wow, this is, you know, X amount of dollars. I bought it 6 months ago and it was Y amount of dollars, and that's inflation.
I hear that in the salon all the time too, like where people never talked about prices of anything. People talked about always like what they're doing, where they're going, money they're spending, having fun doing all these things. But it just feels like now you hear grocery store talk all the time. Like everyone's like, oh my God, can you believe the price of, you know, or going out to dinner is so expensive now, even fast food is so expensive. Like everyone just talks about life being so expensive, and it feels like people are strangled.
Yeah. Even in the U.S. now, because this used to be something that's characteristic of, I don't know, Argentina or Zimbabwe or places like that, or Lebanon. And now it's happening in the U.S., not to as extreme a degree, but it's happening.
It definitely doesn't feel, over the years, middle class felt like comfort. You know, it felt like you're not rich, but you're okay. You have what you need. You know, your kids will have what they need when they grow up. You'll have enough to help them with a wedding and down payment in a house, and you'll have 3-4 kids and be able to help them. That's what middle class seemed like before.
Yeah.
With one income, right?
That's another good point. With one income, not needing both parents to work.
Yeah. Now you have two parents working, you have crazy amount of bills, and you're worried about helping your kid with a wedding, and even thinking about a down payment of a house is ridiculous. You're like, you're just going to live with me when you get married, I guess. That's what people are just thinking. I mean, it has changed. It's not like most people, unless you're outside of middle class and you're upper, you know, on a different tier, those worries aren't affecting you as much. Like you're actually thinking, you know, that doesn't bother you, that I'm sounding crazy. But anybody who's in this middle class section is probably feeling the same way. I don't think people are thinking like,
it's funny. They used to say, when you kind of say, oh, I'm in the middle class, you used to say, I'm comfortable. And now people are getting less comfortable, you know?
Yeah. And how uncomfortable do you need to get before you start finding out the answer, before you start figuring out what the problem is? And I think that's what the whole point is. Figure out what the problem is, and then learn that a book that lays it out like your book does, to be able to not have to trust an institution to hold your Bitcoin for you, to make sure that you can be your own bank, is not difficult. It just takes a little bit of learning.
It's not difficult, you're right.
It's really not. It's
just a step-by-step thing. You learn one simple step, and then the next simple step, and then the next one.
And I love that you say, start with a small amount of money, you know, buy $25 worth of Bitcoin.
Oh, absolutely, for sure. Because that takes away one of the scariest things, which is, oh, I'm going to lose, you know, a lot of money. No, you can't, because the most you can lose is what you put into it. And if that's $25, then you can only lose $25.
That's like half a trip to McDonald's for the family, you know?
It's like, since inflation, yeah, it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's so true. So it's like, okay, fine, you know, half of your family for lunchtime, you know? So it's like... you missed out on that. Yeah. But it's like, yeah, it's not a lot to play with. You could do it with $5 in Bitcoin if you wanted to send it. Who cares? You know, but
actually,
just...
now you almost could, because the transaction fee, because the thing is, you're making a lot of transactions because you want to get practice with transactions. So I have them set up a total of 4 different wallets and do a bunch of transactions and restore and recover and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, the fees are so low that you can do it. I mean, the fees is like 0.2 sats per V-byte. That's the lowest I've ever seen.
You know what would be cool?
What's that?
I love your idea of the book, and I love the idea of, you know, how people used to do, you know, coding classes or something, but then it would be like Bitcoin recovery, Bitcoin wallet classes. Then you just have like, hey, it's like a 2-day thing, or you know, 2-day thing you sign up for, and you go in and you just do this a bunch of times and talk to Bitcoin people and figure it out together and like learn, ask questions about Bitcoin. But it's like almost like Bitcoin school instead of coding school. And it'd be super easy because you're doing it with other people and practicing.
Yeah.
So I think those would be really cool to see things like that come up, where it could be like, hey, come in and learn how to do this. Super easy. You know?
Yeah. I've actually thought about doing some online seminars. I've done a few in-person seminars.
Mm-hmm.
And what I really get from that is we are still so early, because people are very interested. As a matter of fact, I did a seminar. I thought I was going to actually do a seminar and actually go through the exercises, But it turns out that everybody came just to hear more about Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just had to talk instead of actually helping people through the exercises, which was fine. But yeah, so in-person seminars, I don't know if it's easy enough to get a big group of people who are interested enough and confident enough to actually do it.
You know what I think? It's like my idea is, again, and I would want this to be a thing. I agree with you. I think online is definitely more realistic.
Yeah.
But this is just, again, my mind just thinking about what I think would be cool to see. But it would be nice to see it in neighborhoods where people aren't well off, because you would want them to empower themselves and to be able to use Bitcoin and know you can do it. But the places that I see this being more of a, like, sadly, this would be the places it would work, would be in areas where you have, you know, more affluent communities, because I've seen things around where it's like Mathnasium and Code Ninjas and like those, where it's almost like a trendy place where parents are like, oh, I signed my kid up to that new place. You know, so if it's like a Bitcoin wallet place, it's like, oh, let's figure out how to transfer with this new technology and like how to use that. It's something new. And I think people want to be the trendy parents.
That's an interesting idea. Bitcoinnasium.
Bitcoinnasium. It's like, Bitcoin Ninjas, Bitcoin, you know, so it'd be like something like that, because people will, and honestly, me and my husband were looking into it for our kids, one of those math or code places, which I feel like nowadays with AI, you don't even need those code places. They probably gone out of business. But parents back then were signing up their kids for these super expensive courses. Mm. And we didn't do it because we're like, yeah, maybe not, you know, but they did it because they're like, my kid goes here. They want to be like bragging that their kid goes to this cool new place.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting, I don't know. I think that might be something that could be a cool thing that parents would pay for, because parents want to sign their kid up to everything. But I just wish it could be more like everywhere, not just in places where people want to pay a lot for.
Yeah. You know? I wonder though, sometimes probably it is true that most of the people who own Bitcoin are people who have some extra. But a lot of times people who have more money have made it all in the stock market, or have made a lot of it in the stock market through index funds. And they're just kind of not prepared to open their eyes to something new.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that Bitcoin adoption won't just be with the wealthy. It'll be more widespread.
Yeah. And maybe somebody, like you said, like Bitcoiners that have made money on Bitcoin over time and want to do something to help educate young people or whatever, they don't have to be like, I'm going to charge an arm and a leg for this thing and open up places. Maybe it could be something someone wants to do just for the benefit of helping people learn, you know, and it doesn't have to be a money-making thing, you know, it could be.
Yeah. That's kind of one of the things. So I, since the book is not very expensive, I mean, it's just a book, it's not a class or anything, not an in-person class. Mm-hmm. So I made it less expensive on purpose, but as it is less expensive, I don't really have any money for advertising.
Yeah.
So I'm looking for less expensive ideas to kind of promote it.
Exactly.
Because I want to keep it something very accessible, of course.
That would be great. So then if you have your book, definitely I'm going to promote it. I'm going to promote this, you know, even on my channels. I could promote it in my, you know, links for videos for people who want to figure out how to do this on their own, because it's not, doesn't take long. It's not hard. You know, there's a manual for you here. It's easy.
Step by step.
And doing what you're doing is the best, because you're getting out there, you're sharing it, you're, you know, on my show. And I, you know, I would love it if, you know, you went on more shows and talked about this more. And have you been on many podcasts talking about your book yet?
No, you're the first, actually.
Yes. Okay. That's amazing.
I was working on some other projects, and so I haven't made a big push on marketing. So now I have two pushes. One is marketing and one is getting my next book out.
That's great. So, yeah. And when do you think the timeline is for your next book?
I'm hoping to have finished writing it by the end of the year, and then actually publishing it and doing the cover art and all that kind of stuff, hopefully by early next year. I mean, really early, like first couple of weeks, because I already have kind of a template of everything. This is going to be basically, I haven't decided if it's going to be called More Bitcoin Hands-On or Advanced Bitcoin Hands-On.
Okay.
Probably More, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah,
so, it's exciting. It also, I get the chance to experiment with all kinds of different wallets. That's also, it's another reason why I don't tell people rush right out right away and buy a hardware wallet, because if you buy a hardware wallet, at that point, you're making a decision that the cheapest one now, I think, is like $80, and it goes all the way up to like $200, $250 or something like that. And most of them are not wallets, like the Ledger, for instance. It's meant to only do one seed phrase.
Yeah.
Whereas the Seed Signer, which, again, I'm a big fan of the Seed Signer, open source, do-it-yourself wallet, they have a what's called stateless. So you can store, you have the seed phrase, and they actually have a special thing called a seed QR that you can scan so you don't have to type it in, but you put it in, it's basically a signing device. It doesn't hold your keys. So that's.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know
that about the seed signer. I've heard a lot about it, but I didn't realize that.
Seed signer, I like them a lot. They have a very active Telegram group. They're super helpful. Mm-hmm. And I like their ethics a lot. So I push them. But yeah, buying a hardware wallet is expensive. And if you're just interested in learning, first do the learning about what is, you know, what are the elements of self-custody, recovery, wallets, seed phrases, private keys, all of that stuff. And then think about a hardware wallet once your assets are enough to make it worthwhile. And they won't be for a lot of people for a while.
Yeah. And I think that that's why when you have solutions like Nunchuck, you know, and Blue Wallet's a wallet on the phone too.
It's a phone wallet. And actually, I think Blue Wallet has a desktop app, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. But I think most people use it as a phone app.
Okay. Yeah. And that's great because you're able to give people those kind of tools where they could practice doing it. That it's the same exact thing doing it on an app.
Open source, Bitcoin only. So safe in that regard. And speaking of which, a lot of hardware wallets are not Bitcoin only. Trezor's not, Ledger's not, many of them. Most of them, I would say, are not Bitcoin only, which makes them, to me, less trustworthy.
Right. Exactly. I agree. Bitcoin only is the way.
It's the way. It's a good way of getting rid of like 90% of stuff. Because if it's not Bitcoin only, then you don't need to worry about it because it's not really trustworthy.
I agree. That is such a great point. Yeah. Because Bitcoin is, I mean, you're not able to mess with it, hack it. I don't know. There's so many people that can scam you a million different ways with other crypto. So yeah, I don't stand by other crypto. I know that crypto, I hate to say that, I think it could even be used for something in the future, but not money. Like, I don't think it should be money. I don't think it should be anything that you should trust with value of any kind. I think it could maybe do other things, but not. I think Bitcoin is the money. That's where you want to keep that's the kind of wallet you want to use, Bitcoin only wallet. And you reduce your risk that way. I mean, honestly, if you're trying to...
For sure, because there's a much smaller attack surface if you only do Bitcoin. If you do every single coin that's out there, then you have a million things to test. Versus if you do Bitcoin only, then you test Bitcoin only.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you don't have to mess with chains. And there's people that would send money from one chain to another and all these different things and then swapping this and doing that. And it's like, you know what? Just stay away.
Bitcoin only.
Yeah.
It was actually something that Saifedean Ammous wrote in his book, The Bitcoin Standard, about blockchain. Because actually, back when I was a little confused myself years ago about blockchain. And because the Wall Street Journal and all these people were saying, oh, blockchain is so important. And we have to do a blockchain for this and a blockchain for that. And then Saifedean Ammous had a real good diagram in his book. You know, if you're considering a blockchain project, it's basically, is what you're trying to store on the blockchain money? Yes or no? If yes, then store it on a blockchain. If no, then you don't need a blockchain. It's not worth it. It's like a super duper expensive decentralized database that is absolutely not worth it, except for one case in which you're tracking money, which is Bitcoin, then yes, it's worth it.
And then use Bitcoin. Yeah. So it's like it all leads back to
that. It's like it's blockchain, you know. Bitcoin is not really that important, but blockchain, on the other hand, that's what the hype used to be.
Oh.
And still is for some people. But yeah, I don't believe that.
I don't know. I think people try to manipulate you with those terms because they think like, oh, if you think you missed out on Bitcoin because you're late, then check out this blockchain thing. It's like a word that they use, but it's like Bitcoin is a blockchain. It's the OG blockchain.
The only one that's decentralized. Really.
Yeah, the immutable decentralized, you know, nobody controls it. Nobody could switch the rules, you know, and it's literally like the only best one, you know, so it's like, I don't know. I just think it's such a marketing tactic for people to be like, well, it's I don't know, a cool new word. Like if you see blockchain ninjas, then it's like, oh, no, stay away from that. Don't do that one.
A good hint, sir.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for joining me on my show. Thank you for reaching out. And I can't wait to share your book. I can't wait to tell people that are looking into doing their own, you know, self-custody. I will definitely share this with everybody. And I'm so excited about your second book, too. And if you want to join me again for that, I would love to have you back.
Awesome. Thank you. I really appreciate being on the show and being able to share my story and chat with you.
Yes, thank you so much. And, congrats on the book and, good job trying to help people.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yes, take care. Have a great day. Bye-bye.